Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. That war just got a bit hotter over the 4th of July holiday as a result of an intercontinental ballistic missile test, the first, by Kim Jong-un's regime in North Korea. A very ominous sign, and we will be discussing it with a number of our guests in the course of the program, starting with our first, the chairman and president of an indispensable organization, the Foundation for Resilient Societies. He is Tom Popeck, an MIT-trained engineer and Harvard MBA, formerly served in the United States Air Force, and most recently, on the 22nd of June, testified with a very timely message to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission about electric grid security. We want to talk with Tom about the implications of what the North Koreans are up to for the security of our grid and, for that matter, of our country. And I couldn't be more pleased to welcome him back. Tom, so good to have you. Thanks for taking a few minutes.
Thank you very much, Frank.
Tom, I want to talk to you about this missile test, but it's not the only threat that we're facing. So I want to draw on your expertise to discuss other capabilities that the North Koreans have been bringing to bear of late that may well be even more ominous than the one that we're preoccupied with at the moment, namely this long-range missile. Talk, if you would, about both and get to the point that you were discussing with the FERC as a very serious concern, namely the vulnerability of our electric grid.
That's exactly right, Frank. We really need to start with the vulnerability of our critical infrastructure, especially the U.S. electric grid, because that makes so many other attack vectors feasible for nations such as North Korea. And those attack vectors include electromagnetic pulse attack by an intercontinental ballistic missile, but also cyber attack and physical attack. As a matter of fact, there could be combined attacks by these rogue nations. Really, it's the vulnerability of the grid. We have very long-distance electricity transmission in the United States. We're increasingly dependent on variable generation sources such as wind and solar that cannot be used for baseload power or to restore the grid. The dual fuel capability in electric generation plants is increasingly being taken out of the grid, and that reduces resiliency too to all these different attack vectors by rogue nations.
So to put it in layman's terms, the grid that essentially powers all aspects of modern life in 21st century America is at risk of design and deliberate attacks. For that matter, I guess not simply by nations, but by subnational actors as well, running the gamut from the most prosaic of physical sabotage and of course, cyber attacks, but also this this phenomenon of electromagnetic pulse, or EMP. And Tom Popeck, would you describe what we think we know about North Korea's pursuit of particularly that latter capability, the EMP threat?
Certainly. We know that North Korea has nuclear weapons. It's not a large stockpile, so we have to ask ourselves if North Korea were to attack another nation, including the United States, with nuclear weapons, what would be the most effective way to do it? With just a dozen or so nuclear weapons, they might be able to use blast and shock effects on one or more cities, but potentially a far more dangerous attack for the United States would be an electromagnetic pulse attack, take out the electric grid and then cause massive societal disruption. Think about all the critical infrastructure that depends on electricity. We'll start with water and sanitation, and then, of course, a lot of government services, such as police and fire protection, food distribution. That kind of attack, although it may not have the same immediate effect as a nuclear weapon going off in a major city, potentially the casualties from an electromagnetic pulse attack could be far greater.
Yeah, by some estimates, including that of the chairman of the Congressional EMP Threat Commission, a man you know well, as do I, Dr. William Graham, perhaps 9 out of 10 Americans would perish if there's a large scale blackout over much of the country. And the question, I guess, Tom Popick, is this. As an engineer, as someone who has devoted much of your life to analyzing these sorts of threats and helping the country contend with them, is it your view, Tom, that this missile that was tested on the 4th of July represents a significant new degree of danger to this country because it could be used in an EMP mode, or is the danger already very high as a result of other capabilities, perhaps including satellites that the North Koreans already have at hand?
Sure. There's been speculation that the North Koreans could put a small nuclear warhead on a satellite, and that satellite could then detonate the nuclear warhead over the United States, producing an EMP attack. There's also been speculation that the North Koreans could place a mobile missile on a ship-based platform and use that to overcome some of the range limitations of their missiles. I would say, though, probably the most certain launch capability is from the North Korean peninsula, and that's why this increasing range of their missiles really is becoming an ever more immediate threat. Were the North Koreans to use a ship-based attack, of course, there's the potential for our U.S. Navy to intercept that ship before it reaches the coast of the United States. And so I do think that this is really an important new development in the North Korean threat.
Tom, as I mentioned, you spoke before the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the outfit that nominally at least has responsibility for assuring that our grid is secure and resilient. Tell us very quickly what you said to the commissioners and how they took your message.
Well, certainly. I talked about the threat of a long-term electric grid outage. And what is a long-term electric grid outage? Well, it's an outage that persists longer than the capacity for backup power in the electric grid and related infrastructure, especially telecommunications. And it's an outage that is over such a wide area that it's impractical for significant outside assistance to be provided. The United States has never experienced a long-term outage under that definition. We've had long outages of small geographic areas where there can be outside assistance. I think the outage in Louisiana during Hurricane Katrina would be an example of that. But there was still significant outside assistance, and in many cases, the restoration was accomplished in approximately 24 hours or less. So we really haven't experienced this, but were we to experience it, it really could be a catastrophic circumstance. And so I outlined that possibility during my testimony. I also talked about we can be more resilient to a long-term outage if we have dual fuel capability at generation plants. For example, we're getting much more natural gas generation. And at one point in time, over 95% of these plants also had an oil tank on site. So if there was an interruption in the natural gas flow, the generation could continue. But a lot of those oil tanks have been taken out for environmental and other reasons. And so that's taking the resiliency out of the system. And I do think that there was a good degree of interest from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission on some of the things that we had to say in regard to long-term outage.
This is a vulnerability that we can do something about. And Tom Popeck at the Foundation for Resilient Societies, nobody's doing more to that end than you. We are really grateful to you for your leadership. I hope you will keep up that good work, my friend, and you'll be welcome here anytime. And I hope you will come back to us again very soon.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's time for our regular visit each week with Diana West, an extraordinary syndicated columnist of many years. She is also a blogger par excellence at dianawest.net and the author of two terrific and best-selling books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. She is frequently now read at the Daily Caller as well as her own website, and it's always a delight to have a chance to visit with her. Diana, thank you so much for taking a few minutes. Good to talk with you.
Wonderful to be with you. Yes.
Totalitarianism is on my mind at the moment. We're watching with great and growing alarm about the threat posed from North Korea and the support it is getting from the communist Chinese in mounting that threat. I also want to talk to you a little bit about Vladimir Putin, who President Trump will be seeing a little bit later this week. We'll be talking about these with several of our guests in the course of the program. But you've studied this phenomenon very closely, Diana, notably in your terrific book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. Talk a little bit about, you know, what makes these guys tick and the dangers associated with the West seemingly chronically underestimating.
Yes, well, chronically underestimating the long-term strategy that these kinds of nations follow. They pursue, they develop, they think about these things. We tend to look at them in increments of months, maybe presidential terms, hot spots. Where did that come from? It often seems to be the question on our policymakers' minds, whereas these problems and these aggressions and these forces are all rooted in an ideology of expansion, communism, totalitarianism, that go back way into our previous century, and certainly in this iteration, this cycle. So this is, I think, the most important point to make, that this is a long-range kind of threat.
And we underestimate it at our extreme peril. Diana West is our guest, and we're talking about this long-range ideological drive of some of the most dangerous people on the planet, and certainly Kim Jong-un of North Korea would qualify, as I would argue, does Xi Jinping, his sponsor, his patron, his enabler in Beijing. Another, as we'll talk about shortly with Stephen Blank, is Vladimir Putin, Dinah West. And one of the things that I was struck by in a piece that Dr. Blank wrote recently was a comparison to Stalin, when he was describing Putin. And I'm interested in your thoughts, again, having studied Stalin's handiwork, if you can call it that, closely during the run-up to World War II and during the war and immediately thereafter in American Betrayal. Do you see parallels between Putin and Stalin? And again, is it important that we not misestimate what Putin is about?
Yes. Well, I think the word parallel is maybe not the best word. Again, going to this notion of a continuum, I think that we've been beguiled by what we look back on as a victory in the Cold War, as the disappearance of the Soviet Union. And this is something that I dwell on and drill down on in American Betrayal, having been beguiled by, for example, President Reagan and President Bush's quote, victory in the Cold War and the disappearance of the Soviet Union, which we have sort of based all of our policymaking vis-a-vis Russia and Moscow and its satellites ever since. And I think this is the great success of, again, long-range communist Soviet strategy that allowed some of the most, what do they call it, revanchist or retrograde forces within Soviet society to survive, to reconstitute themselves, to rename themselves, to relabel. But essentially, for example, in the KGB, did not go away. There was no true revolution in Moscow in the way the government is run, in the way the government survives. And I think that what we looked at was this massive influx of Western capital into Russia, this supposed disappeared Soviet, post-Soviet state. And now we're looking at its recreation. And so in that sense, I think that the comparisons are valid, certainly for instruction. And I think it's very important to look at how Russian society is still enamored of Stalin. Stalin recently came out in a Russian poll just in the last few weeks in the highest esteem. He may have been number one in terms of the Russian historical figure, I'm trying to remember, but he's certainly at the top. Putin also near the top. And this is a very important point to remember, because if the Russian people truly, if this is an expression of some Russian sentiment, this is a very important thing to understand what they are teaching and how they still view themselves.
Let me ask you about one other form of totalitarianism. As we've talked about frequently on this program, Diana, one of the most courageous leaders in resisting that I think of as Sharia supremacism in our time is Geert Wilders of the Netherlands. You have on your terrific blog, dianawest.net, an important conversation, a debate, I guess you'd call it, between Geert Wilders, a parliamentarian in the Netherlands, and his prime minister recently. Talk a little bit about the exchange and what our takeaway should be from it.
Yes, well, Geert Wilders at this point is leading the second largest party in the Netherlands. So he has a very formidable following and speaks for many, many Dutch people. And he essentially has been speaking truth to power for his entire career, starting as a party of one to this point of leadership in the country. And in this recent debate, it was essentially the same debate that it's been the entire time. But now he is speaking directly to the prime minister, and it is an exchange among near equals in terms of power. And what we're looking at is, we were talking about totalitarianism a little while ago. We're looking at a version of it in terms of the prime minister attempting to enforce the big lie that everything is okay. I mean, this is a basis of totalitarianism in terms of enforcing a narrative, which may be exactly what the Russian government is doing in still enshrining Stalin, as you know, perhaps not really an expression of what Russian people think, but telling you what the state thinks. And what the prime minister of the Netherlands thinks is that the mass migration that is Islamizing the Netherlands is fine, is something that we can do better with, that we can bring these people into the fabric of our society, and we have not done so sufficiently, whereas you have Geert Wilders speaking the truth in terms of the utter desecration, disappearance, deterioration of the Dutch culture and state. And that is sort of the essence of this debate as it has gone on. And in terms of protecting the Dutch people, the government has failed. But the government will not talk about that, will not address this, and will essentially continue to enforce a very Marxist kind of multicultural line that everything is fine, we just need to do better, and essentially you need to shut up. And that is kind of the state of affairs at this point.
Diana, we have to leave it at that for the moment. There's so much more to talk about, and we'll look forward to doing so with you again next week. In the meantime, thank you for your time today, and stay well. Next up, Dr. Stephen Blank will join us as promised. We'll explore whether, as he suggests, Putin thinks he's at war with the West. What are the implications of that? Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. Our guest is Dr. Stephen Blank. He is these days a senior fellow for Russia at the American Foreign Policy Council. Having capped a distinguished career as a professor of national security studies at the Army War College, an extraordinarily prolific contributor to public policy debate about, Russia, the former Soviet Union, and our interests as they bear upon the ambitions most immediately of the guy who is running the Kremlin, Vladimir Putin. Stephen Blank, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Well, good morning, Frank. It's great to be here.
I wanted to start with the travels the president has embarked upon this week. He will be getting to the Russians in a little bit, but most immediately he's stopping in Warsaw to make what is considered to be a major speech about U.S.-European relations. Talk a little bit about what's going on there at the moment and the importance of that speech as you see it, Steve.
Well, what's going on in Poland, really there's two more or less simultaneous summits taking place in Warsaw. One is President Trump's visit. The other is a program called the Three Cs, which is a Polish initiative which used to be called Intermarium, which is Latin for between the seas, to create some sort of unity in Central and Eastern Europe between the Baltic, Black, and Adriatic seas. Right now, the program is essentially an attempt to gain some sort of investment and trade unity among those states, but it's clear that the government in Warsaw has a broader agenda. And it will be interesting to see if Trump will support that agenda, because that would have significant implications for European security. At the same time, he is going to make a speech in Warsaw, whose terms we don't know yet, outlining his administration's views on European security. And Warsaw is a great place to make it, because Poland is an up-and-coming economic country. It is a staunch ally of the United States and member of NATO and of the European Union. And its security is very much at risk from Russian aggression in Ukraine and threats launched by Russia against the Baltic states and against Poland. So it's important for Trump to show the flag, so to speak, in Warsaw. And I think to outline what I hope will be a robust U.S. policy regarding European security.
One of the recommendations you've made in the Wall Street Journal last week, Steve Blank, was to arm Ukraine. Talk a little bit about how that fits into a strategy of strengthening our ties to the Europeans, and particularly at this moment, as things are looking rather dark with the Russians.
Well, as everybody knows, Russia's aggression against Ukraine continues, and every day there are probes by the Russian forces. It's not right to call them separatists. They are fully integrated now into the Russian army. Against Ukrainian forces on Ukrainian territory, and the Ukrainian military, for all of its prowess and bravery, is overmatched in terms of weapons and has taken a lot of casualties, and the country has taken a lot of casualties and absorbed millions of refugees. So the idea of giving Ukraine weapons that are defensive, counter-battery, anti-tank, and so on, would be a means for them to equalize the situation and impose greater costs on Russia in order to force Russia to go back and observe the Minsk Accords, which are the only political process going with Ukraine. Russia has refused to adopt these, and instead is demanding that the U.S. impose on Ukraine what I call an assisted suicide in accepting these proposals, which would essentially undermine Ukrainian sovereignty de facto. Unless somebody steps up and forces the Kremlin to accept the higher costs of its aggression, then we're going to have this situation going on. We're going to have a massive Russian military buildup, which is occurring inside of Russia near Ukraine, and a state of armed siege in Europe, which benefits nobody, really. I hope that Trump will take this opportunity to stand in the line of American presidents going back to Truman, where our policy has been to support people who want to defend their own freedom and give them the means to do so.
You've described in some detail in both the piece that you had in the Wall Street Journal, as I mentioned, and in Newsweek, what this looks like. I'm wondering whether there is now in prospect, as a result of what you've kind of described as a new Stalin in the Kremlin, in Vladimir Putin, a man who can only be dissuaded from engaging in such behavior by a very dramatic buildup in military capabilities on the part of the West as well.
Well, when I said it's in nobody's interest, I meant in terms of people. It's in Vladimir Putin and his entourage's interest to incite a state of siege or hostility between Russia and the West. It's certainly not in the Russian people's interest, because if you look at what's happening inside Russia, they're paying a very severe price. The true costs are being hidden, but the fact is that there was nobody in Western Europe, in Europe at all, or in the United States, who was threatening Russia's security. This is all a fantasy made up by Putin to stay in power. As a result of his desire to stay in power, and when I used the analogy to Stalin in the article last week, it's not that he is Stalin. We haven't gotten to that level, thank God. But that he has more power, I think, over Russia than anybody since Stalin. And that's going back to 1953. What he is now showing in his domestic policies is that he is deathly afraid of the possibility that the Russian people may take out their frustrations by demonstrating against or even attacking his own regime, because he has created hundreds of units involving thousands of people who are armed in order to protect the regime against its own people. There are what professionals call multiple militaries inside of Russia, under his personal control, under the government's control, and so forth, whose main mission seems to be just to keep Vladimir Putin in power and suppress demonstrations, and if need be, violently. We also have seen many political murders and threats of violence against dissidents, including the return of the Gulag and even psychiatric prisons under Putin.
When you see the president of the United States sitting down, as he's expected to, on the margins of the G20 meeting in Hamburg this week, with Vladimir Putin, what would your counsel be to President Trump? How to handle him? What sorts of steps should be taken? Well, in the run-up to it, I suppose, but certainly what kind of posture struck at that meeting as well?
President Trump needs to take the line that although we would like to be able to cooperate with Russia on issues of mutual interest, or what we think should be mutual interest, the fact is that Russia is undermining itself by attempting to attack the United States. Russia, for example, is following China's lead on Korea. I don't really see how it benefits Russia to have North Korea as a nuclear power, yet they are acting as, along with China, as North Korea's defense attorney on that issue. In the Middle East, they are supporting a government of Syria which is, I think, untenable in the midterm, not even in the long term, and is going to suck out resources from Russia in the vain pursuit that Russia can chase the will of the wisp of being a great power in the Middle East against the will of local residents. Militarily in Europe, it invaded Ukraine on a pretext. That has gotten very little benefit to Russia and is costing the Russian people a great deal. And it's also threatening Russian security by its threatening Russia, Europe, which is much more powerful and which has now begun to rearm. I would make it clear to Putin that we intend to keep going as we have unless he understands that we have no ulterior motive other than defense of our interests, and that he is aiming to put Russia into the condition that he most dreads, that is upheaval. There are things that can be done with Russia and for Russia's benefit by the United States, which are also to our benefit. For example, stopping nonproliferation. But if he insists on thwarting those kinds of objectives, then he and the Russian people will have to pay the price, and we intend to enforce it. On the other hand, if there's a basis for negotiation, fine.
Thank you so much for the great work you do, Steve, at the American Foreign Policy Council, and your many, many contributions. Some 900 monographs, scholarly articles, and books are an impressive documenting of these challenges, and we look forward to further visit with you soon. Next up, Diana West joins us. We'll talk about totalitarians in our time and lessons from the past, as well as the Islamist threat at the moment in Europe and here. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're joined by Kevin Freeman, our duty expert on matters involving, well, economics in general, but specifically economic warfare, a subject in which he has proven to be quite an expert. He is a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, I'm very pleased to say, but also the driving force behind globaleconomicwarfare.com, and also a soon-to-be star of stage and screen, hosting his own television program on the Blaze Network entitled Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. Check out his two best-selling books, Secret Weapon and Game Plan. Kevin Freeman, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's always good to have you.
Great. Thanks, Frank.
I'm listening to a lot of conversations at the moment, Kevin, as I'm sure you are, about what to do about the North Koreans. And we were talking earlier in the program with Tom Popick about the possibility of a very present danger from them, namely of an electromagnetic pulse, the subject of considerable attention in your book, Game Plan. Kevin, in terms of the options available to the United States, it would appear that the most significant, the most promising form of pressure on the North Korean regime actually lies with China. What are your thoughts on that at the moment? Can we continue to hope the Chinese will solve this problem for us, or do we have to do something to incentivize them to do so?
Well, we can hope that the Chinese will focus on it, because certainly China would not want to see an EMP devastated United States at this point. I don't think that they're prepared economically to deal with it. I think they have their own path and plan for global economic dominance, and to see 20+% of the world's economy wiped out by an EMP would be a bad thing for them. On the other hand, they have their own purposes, their own plans and intents, and I don't know that they're ready to be used by us as a weapon to stop North Korea.
Gordon Chang has written an interesting piece at the Daily Beast about the series of steps that the U.S. government seems to have taken to begin turning up the heat on the Chinese. And I know you haven't seen this piece, Kevin, but I wonder if you look at the sort of very warm embrace, literally, of Narendra Modi, the Prime Minister of India, and designating the Chinese as a Tier 3 human trafficking source, and sanctions on a bank and a shipping company there that are prominently involved with the North Koreans, and a $1.4 billion arms sale to Taiwan. It certainly would seem as though the U.S. government is deciding that this love fest that the president was trying to conjure with Xi Jinping of China seems to have run its course. Is that your reading?
Well, we have ratcheted up. These were threats early on from the Trump administration. You'll play ball with us, and we certainly have acknowledged a series of problems that the Chinese have, and we are applying pressure, and they are subject to pressure. I mean, the Chinese economy is not in tremendous shape. At the same time, however, they've been rapidly advancing their own directions that could turn up the heat on the United States. So we are seeing the beginnings of an economic war, and North Korea could be the trigger for it in many ways.
Well, talk a little bit about what the Chinese are doing, this ratcheting up, as you put it, particularly with respect to the long-term goal, it seems, of the Chinese to supplant the U.S. dollar as the reserve currency of the world. We've talked about this a lot over the years, but it seems as though the building blocks are really inexorably now falling into place for doing just that. Is that how you see it?
Well, absolutely. For example, the Chinese, starting in 2013,
decided that they needed to de-Americanize the world and remove the dollar as the primary reserve currency. And year by year, they've undertaken steps. For example, they led the BRIC nations in 2014 to build a $100 billion fund that would bypass the dollar. They created an alternative to the global international payment system known as SWIFT. They've created their own bank to compete against the World Bank. They really forced the renminbi into the IMF SDR basket, which would be an alternative reserve currency. But most recently, they've been opening up their bond markets, and that's absolutely one of those important steps if you're going to have a challenging position to the U.S. dollar. They've been doing this systematically with announcements every year on a regular basis. We intend to replace the U.S. dollar as the primary reserve currency, and they've just been executing.
At what point does this actually translate into the dollars essentially neutralizing as a reserve currency? Or do you anticipate, Kevin Freeman, that it will continue to be one of the reserve currencies, but not the preeminent one?
Here's the problem: is it shows up in the next financial crisis. The next opportunity where China's economy appears strong and our economy appears weak, they then have this kill shot that removes the U.S. dollar as being a response or an answer. And so it becomes literally another one of those powerful weapons that they hold till the timing is right, like, you know, in the EMP or whatever, but this becomes that devastating economic weapon. So when we enter a financial crisis, we can't just assume with American arrogance, well, we can solve it by printing more money or having the Federal Reserve produce more credit. It literally becomes we enter a crisis and China can then pull the rug out from under us.
Yeah. Say that again, because this is a critically important point. The reserve currency status of the dollar has enabled us to essentially rack up this enormous debt on our credit card, right? And if we are not in that position, we're going to have a very difficult time doing so. Is that right?
Yes, just imagine it's as if we've had an unlimited credit card, and every time we got into a financial problem or crisis, we just put it on the credit card. Families do that, but at some point, that credit line ends, and the Chinese are putting in place those things necessary to where they can choose when our credit line ends as opposed to we choose it.
And if they do pull the plug on it, if they are successful, Kevin Freeman, what are the implications when we look at the, for example, the interest rates on our debt and the sustainability of our budget as a result?
Well, if we have $20 trillion of debt, which we currently have, and interest rates are, you know, averaging 2 to 3%, just imagine if they were averaging 5 to 6%. If you have 5% interest on $20 trillion, you owe $1 trillion a year just in interest, which would soak up a huge percentage of all federal debt receipts. And in other words, it would push us towards that point where we would be the one going to the IMF or to the Chinese or someone else for a desperate bailout, and they would set the terms on how we would do that.
Kevin, I wanted to turn quickly before we ran out of time to one other issue. Qatar increasingly seems to be responding to the pressure on it from the Saudis and others in the Gulf by flaunting its gas strength. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, the Qataris have an enormous gas reserves, and they're just threatened to increase the amount that they would produce and throw onto global markets in the form of liquefied natural gas, or LNG. Which goes directly contrary to the Trump administration's plans to make U.S. energy dominant and us ratchet up our LNG. So we're seeing right now an energy war, the kind of energy war that that drives prices down and threatens producers. So this is their response: we'll just produce more LNG, and that'll solve our economic problems.
Yeah. Well, it'll certainly punish the United States, apparently, for, as they see it, I guess, backing the Saudis in this struggle. Kevin, so much more to talk about. We'll look forward to doing so with you again next week. Thank you for your time today and for your expertise. Check out Kevin's work at globaleconomicwarfare.com and come back to us soon.
go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. It is my high pleasure to welcome once again a woman who I have admired greatly over the years for her clarity of understanding of a problem that most of us are completely clueless about, but that is perhaps as important to the well-being and the fighting trim of our military as any, namely the culture of the military and the ability of our warfighters to focus on the job they must perform, their mission to defend us. She is Elaine Donnelly. She is the founder and president of an incredibly important organization, the Center for Military Readiness. She has served on several important government commissions over the years, including the Defense Advisory Committee on Women and the Armed Services, and a presidential commission also looking into women in combat. She is an incredible resource and a dear friend, and we're always glad to have her here. Elaine Donnelly, welcome back.
Thank you, Frank, for all those kind words.
Well, they are heartfelt and well-deserved, I want to make clear. I want in particular to signal how much I appreciate the work that you have put into what seems to be at least a reprieve from some of the Obama administration's, I call it wrecking operation, social engineering, shall we call it, namely the announcement of Friday evening, I believe it was, of the holiday weekend, that the transgender policy was going to be under review for the next 6 months. Talk a little bit about that policy in the first place and what it means that this reprieve has been announced.
Well, thank you. Yes, this was a positive development that the Secretary of Defense, General Mattis, James Mattis, decided not to proceed with a deadline set by his predecessor, Ashton Carter, saying that by July 1, the military would start recruiting new transgender people into the armed forces. However, he could have done even more. I would like to know more about why the Army, the Marine Corps, and the Air Force asked for a two-year delay in implementation of this policy. Coming between those three chiefs and the Secretary of Defense was an Obama holdover, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, Robert Work. And Robert Work persuaded the, maybe he twisted arms, to get the three services to agree to only a six-month temporary delay. Now, the problem with that is it kicks the can down the road to the holiday season, Christmas and New Year's. All of the directives put in place by the Obama administration are still there, and they will kick in automatically on autopilot on January 1 unless someone intervenes, namely the Secretary of Defense or possibly the United States Congress. So 6 months, forget it. We'll have like maybe 3 or 4 months to influence what happens next, and I think that's the way Robert Work planned it. He's done it before.
What is the issue here that is animating this decision? It's hard to believe that this is driven by a conviction that the readiness of our military will be enhanced by injecting such individuals into the services. There are some there already, evidently. But based on your study of this, what is your sense of the advisability of this decision?
We have yet to find out what has happened with the transgenders in the military right now. We need to find out exactly how this has worked out in the past year before proceeding to the next stage, bringing in recruits who are transgender before that kicks in. We're talking about the individuals. They're a small minority of people, and you have to have sympathy for people who are confused about their sexual identity. And it's encouraging that at least three of the four services did ask for a two 2-year delay. But there is no good time to implement bad policy. And this is bad policy. What we're going to see here are people subjected to, well, they're going to get lifelong hormone treatments, sometimes irreversible surgeries, very expensive. The low-ball estimates from the LGBT activist groups really don't count. We're going to see infringements on personal privacy in conditions of forced intimacy, women having to put up with gender pretenders, perhaps, going into their private spaces where men don't belong. We're going to see violations of conscience on the part of doctors and nurses. We're also going to see negative impacts on deployability. There's also a network of remote service central coordination cells, or SCCCs, that will allow LGBT consultants to politicize the military health system. We're going to see an erosion of trust in military leaders and a diversion of scarce time and resources to these politically correct social agendas.
Are you saying that the expenses associated with these procedures, however costly they are, will be borne by the military healthcare system, which is already overburdened and an incredible burden on the military's other accounts?
That's right. And don't forget the Veterans Administration, which is already overburdened. Once you to say that this particular cohort of people who suffer from a medical condition called gender dysphoria, they are more special than others who have mental conditions that disqualify them from military service. If they are to have access to the military with all benefits the same, including in veteran status after they leave the military for lifelong periods, you really are politicizing everything about the military. The armed forces are being asked to cope with less deployability, people who are not available to be sent overseas. There's even a warning in one of the documents about certain countries that don't tolerate people who are cross-dressers. So they're not going to be deployable to many parts of the world where our military exists. This is the first time that there's been a close look at exactly what the LGBT groups have in mind for our military. It is quite clear that they helped to write these directives, and they are still in the Pentagon directing what will come next. This, talk about draining the swamp. The Secretary of Defense, we don't need a mad dog, we don't need a sleeping dog, we need a watchdog, someone who will look at this situation and apply the principles that he talked about in his confirmation hearing. He said the primary consideration will be mission readiness and combat lethality. If you apply those two principles to this array of, well, I would say rather nutty proposals, and they're quite serious about this, the idea that you change a gender marker on a piece of paper and that transforms a man into a woman or a woman into a man, and everybody has to defer to that delusion, you cannot justify these mandates under that kind of a principle.
If the mission is defending the country, this is, I'm certain, an unacceptable price that's being asked of our military to pay. Elaine Donnelly, there's so much more to talk about this, including, among other things, whether other parts of the Obama social engineering agenda are likely to get fresh scrutiny as well, women in combat, gays in the military, and the like. Again, I appreciate your efforts to help all of us understand the better. Give us your website again.
Okay, it is www.cmrlink.org. And look for the news release that's on our, it's a new webpage, by the way, it's still in progress, but we're very pleased with the results so far. The second thing people can do is thank Vicki Hartzler, the representative on the House Armed Services Committee from Missouri, who led a rather spirited debate on this issue in marking up the National Defense Authorization Act. Her leadership was inspiring. She's got a lot of ammunition to work with. The costs and consequences are very great. But just take a look at our report. Do you look at any one of these mandates and you can say, what? Are they really serious about this? It's time to take a really close look at what is in mind here. There is time. The Secretary of Defense has the power to fix this problem.
And we need him to do it. We absolutely need him to do it. And I commend Vicki Hartzler along with you, Elaine Donnelly, as well as your good self and the work you do at the Center for Military Readiness.
From From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.